thanking Andrei for the opportunity to speak here, and also Short, who was a little bit the instigator of this event. Indeed, I published a book on gesture in architecture, a treatise in contemporary mannerism. Unfortunately, it's only in Dutch. The Gestiek van de Architectuur. You can buy it in the bookshop. Well, what are we going to do today? I think my lecture will take something about 50 minutes. And first I'm going to introduce you to some theoretical preliminaries, tell you something about gesture. Then I will tell you something about the thesis of my book, which is that we are actually witnessing a shift from an architecture of space to an architecture of the deep surface. And then we'll dive into the grotto, which was actually one of the nicest rooms in the era of mannerism. And I tell you after that something about the slight bar of scale, the fact that we are giants and, well, say nano dwarfs at the same time today. Then I'll come to some real architectonic questions, Carlos Carper, and the idea of the genetics of the step. I'll tell you something about the virtuoso staircase. And then finally, we will see what deep textures of deep surfaces are. And we'll put on this slide bar of scale ourselves. And we go from texture on the level of the finger to immense textures, finally in, let's say, the texture of the sky, which is at stake in weather. And this is all what you might call dramatization of the surface. Well, during the lecture, I will give you some typical manneristic concepts like meraviglia, oxymoron, virtuosity maybe, and sprezzatura certainly. Well, let's start here then. Gesture. I think it is a little bit topical. We had a very beautiful book of Wilhelm Flusser on gestures, but I think it is a topic in the 20th century overall. I would like you to hold at the back of your mind the etymology of this word, which comes from the Latin word gerere, which means to bring, to carry, or to bear, also in the sense of gestation, to bear a child. We have the form to behave, segerere, and we have suggerere, which is of course to suggest, which is not an official Latin word. It is dog Latin. It was, I think, not coincidentally invented in the 16th century. Now, you have to be aware that in every gesture there are two poles, I think. The pole of spontaneity and the pole of, let's say, behavior. And when we think of spontaneity, you might think of what I'm doing right now, gesticulate when speak. Obviously, there is something in me that does not believe in the communicative powers of language. So I'm already on my way, or a world which is born is already on its way, coming to you, creating a field which is non-discursive, but let's say, like Guarin says it, effective. It's the effective silhouette of language. He even speaks of an animalesque way of saying things. So that's what I do when I gesticulate. On the other pole, we have, of course, if you endlessly repeat gestures, they might become coded. You get behavior, you get habit. And this might extinguish
something like.
It's also an Anglo-Saxon etymology. You see it in Heidegger, for example. when he speaks of Bären, Gebären, and Gebärde, so actually gesture. And explaining that, he uses the words tragen, zu tragen, austragen, and betragen, indeed behavior. Now saying he does not constrict this to, let's say, the human. He says, yes, also things can gesticulate. We know this from the famous band of the substantive to a verb. A thing can think. So this means, ein Ding denkt. And when doing so, it bears world. It bears world forward. Finally, I think the gesture of all gestures is being itself in the philosophy of Heidegger. And this, in, let's say, the dynamic sense of the word, we have nothingness and we have something, and this is the gift of being, as deep. So a very fundamental idea of Gebärden. Now, that's the heavy theoretical part. I will skip this one. I will only say that I consider mannerism to be a twin, a one-act twin, with Renaissance architecture. And if we look at our own time, you might say that, well, the contemporary architecture is a twin with modernist architecture, but a twin which has, in a way, twisted away from its origin. Well, this is what we all know, of course, space. And for a century, the 20th century, everything was space in architecture. You can read it in these famous titles. And if you would look at some 20th century buildings, you could recognize that. You will have always two poles. On the one hand, three-dimensional space, Cartesian space, X, Y, Z, which was largely used to organize the metropolis, to analyze it, to make parts of it, functions, zones, and then to resynthesize it. Objective space. Then, in the post-war period, we get a more subjective space, according to the architects, a humanizing of space, and the concept of room. And this is, well, again, Heidegger. First, you have a thing, might be a work of art, might be a bridge, the bridge is the famous example, might be a heart, but it might also be a cone, an eggs cone, for example. Then you have place, of course, place-space, this was the famous couple. And if you have more places, you might measure the distances between them. And then you can extendedness with any dimensionality you want. Personally, I think in all 20th century architecture, we already see a tendency towards something like deep surface. And I will explain you what this might be. One of the first ones to talk about that was Donald Hoffman in reconstructing the Robey House of Wright, which had been always considered as something very three-dimensional. We know all the crossings of the horizontals and the verticals in the work of Wright. He was the champion of space, we always said. But he said, no, look, there is a relatively flat backside, and everything is protruding from this backside. So actually, you should have to speak of something like a bas relief. And this was a complete other way of looking at those things, which in the post-war period had its summit in this approach of Mr. Rowe, Colin Rowe. Now, I would like to tell you that this concept of deep service is not something new. It was first formulated by Walter Friedlander. And looking at paintings of the 16th century, and he said, well, there is definitely a flattening of pictorial space and indeed a deepening of the surface. We know Deleuze, Shallow Gaps, in his book on the paintings of Francis Bacon. Spiral, deep surface. And in this article of the 50s, Mannerism and Modernism, there was a first confrontation between modern architecture and thought that this architecture might be manneristic. And Colin Rowe, for example, compared the front facade of the Villa Schwab with facades of Zuccari and of Serlio. And he said, well, blind facades, but something is, let's say, digging into the depths of the surface because there is an architectural frame there. Then we got this very famous essay on transparency, literal and phenomenal, in which he compared a painting of Laget with the front facade of the Villa Stein. And he said, well, they are both examples of what I call shallow space. So not deep space. And he said, well, on the one hand, we have perspectival space in modern architecture. But you might say that in this work, we have to look in another way. He said, well, there are a few clues, for example, in the painting of Laget, which say that these are panels which might slide behind each other. And this means actually there is a suggestion of depth. And, well, I think this was quite an endeavor to do the same thing with this front facade. Of course, the Villa Stein is absolutely an object. It's an object in space, like the Villa Savoye was with its windows wrapped around the building. But, said Mr. Rowe, well, if you look carefully, you will see that those windows, yes, they are wrapped a little bit around the room, but there are enough suggestions and clues and indications to take it in another way. And in the first place, Mr. Le Corbusier himself said that you had to approach this building in an axial way, so frontal. There is no diagonal perception. And this means that we have to take seriously every movement in the facade, the advancing of parts and the receding of parts, as in the loggia, the balcony, of course, coming forward, and the back wall of the loggia receding. And he said, for example, those windows, you should see them as a sort of curtain hanging behind the wall, which is actually not the case. They are in the recess of the wall. Now we have a few parallel walls and parapets in the plan itself. And this makes it that we can speak of slots of space behind the facade. So this whole idea of three-dimensional space, which was so dear to Mr. Le Corbusier, was in fact ignored. Now, I don't know what to think about his interpretation. It was, I think, quite hysterical. It even became more hysterical in his reading of La Tourette. We have this enormous blind wall, and he pulls the whole world of the Tourette out of it. The interesting thing, I think, is that he appealed to another human faculty to perceive art. And this faculty, I would call it suspicion. While maybe better the German word Vermutung. And so you react on minor clues a little bit behind the surface suggestions of movement, and you interpret them, and then you might pull that outer world out of it. So, suggestion. And that's where a mannerism, I think, might begin. Well, we all know this game. Dropping a little blot of ink on the paper, then we look at the suggestions of the contours, the movements maybe, we are going to work on it, and finally something appears, always something alive, never any geometry there, and always posture and gesture. Paintings of Michaud, who was a master in this, and Le Chabert, of course. And we call this the grotesque. It's the state of a figure which has not yet escaped matter itself. And the grotesque we meet also in some of the beautiful sketches of Bagafumi, famous mannerist painter. Now remember, the Renaissance time was the time of the disegno, the clear-cut figure which immediately gave you an idea. And here we see that there stays so much matter in the drawing that we have really grotesque figures which are to be judged on their posture, their movements, and their gesture. Well, the grotto then. You see this artist, Buontalenti, in the grotto in the Boboli Garden in Florence. And he is working a little bit between dimensions. He is painting and sculpting at the same time. And you see sometimes a face might be painted. Sometimes it's already on its way of becoming a bas relief. But then again, at the outer side, you see that there's so much matter in it that the figure might fall back in sheer matter. And this is a spume stone, which is a very spongy lava stone. Very beautiful one. It drips off the figures. And if you enter the grotto, you will see that in the middle there is this stone of spume, which in a way is honored. It's put on a pedestal, a fountain. Water was running over it, and this water was also running over the walls. And imagine then that the already uncertain figures became even more uncertain, became fluid, and there were more suggestions on a sort of micro level, but the actual figures run the risk of falling back definitely into this state of stone. So they were, as Maurer puts it, zwischen Gestein und Gestalt, between the stone itself and the figure. And finally, on top of the grotto, there would be a bowl of fish. So actually getting us the idea that we were maybe in this biblical state in which God did not yet sever the waters and the earth. So in a sort of protoplasmatic state. Why? You can see that here. This is really stone come alive, I think. It is really germinating matter. You never will know what will come out of it. Might indeed be a snail in Sweden somewhere in the photo. Might indeed be vegetation. It's all on that grotto. But it might also be an alien. Something which is stuck between a human and a monster. Well, imagine this is completely artificial. but it looks completely natural. And so you can grasp it only in an oxymoron. It's something, well, a natural artifice or artificial nature. You might have met, I think, here already the Manimal, who indeed, if you go to Castello near Florence, in the Grotto of the Animals, you indeed will meet him. Wow, what does that all say? I think a Marist artist is someone who wants to assist to creation. And assisting that in a double sense. In the first place, he really wants to be in matter, inside of matter. Maybe even something like genetic manipulation. That's the one pole. On the other side, I think he already wants matter to have a certain story. He appreciates the manners of matter, and he wants to work on them, and he wants to improve them. Even if that might mean forcing them. Well, we're here then on Hylozoic. Is that the correct pronunciation? Or Hylozoic? We don't know. Hylozoic ground. I think in the first poem, we go a little bit in the direction of a phantasmatic approach. And if you look at the digital grotesque, which is the official title of the works of Michael Hansmeier, well, all printing, digital printing, of course, you might come across a new grotto, but this is actually, I think, wow, on a certain moment it becomes boring because everything is possible. So you stay stuck in your mind, always looking what your mind might produce, and then indeed program it and make such works out of it. The other approach is to look at matter as already always being immaterial. So this means it has a story. It has a biography. So in the first poem we have something like biology, manipulating the genes of matter, and in the second poem we have a sort of biography. We appreciate the matter, we love Earth, and we are going to work on it, and we are going to honor it by really improving it, by forcing the qualities and the properties. And finally, we will end up then on a point where a certain material might mimic another material. As in the beautiful work of Bobby Trunning on the right, ceramics mimicking a little bit soft rolls of foam. Well, that's one too, I think. A very beautiful one. Umbrellas. Actually, material is a very broad concept. And then using them in a way you wouldn't have expected. So the artist is really suspicious of hidden worlds in the material. And he has to put on an extra antenna to really meet the material somewhere halfway and pull this world out of it. Well, this one we know on the left, the chilling cocoon in the library, and the left, the right one is very beautiful too. And we know those stupid air conducting tubes, which have been made to a beautiful texture in the wedding chapel, becoming light conducting tubes. Yeah, this one, famous of course, Louis Kahn. I think he was already busy with that. We know the famous conversation with the brick. And Mr. Khan asks, what do you want to be, brick? Or what do you want, brick? And brick says, I like an arch. Now, why would a brick want an arch? This was something in the Annie conferences in the 90s. There was one conference on tectonics, and everybody laughed him. He was dead, of course, already. And the joke was, well, what a brick wants to be is veneer. It is, of course, a material of the outside today, and it's not a constructive material. Well, I think they didn't understand what he actually meant. What he meant is that any material technique, there is striving in it to become better, to improve itself, to become virtuoso. So what a brick wants to be, what he wants to do actually, is he wants to fly, of course. The heaviest of matter, the stupidest of matter, the lowest form of matter, it wants to fly. It wants to fly in the arch, of course. So that's really levitation. Might be a constructive arc, might be a decorative arc. And finally, it becomes a double curved arch, something like the ultimate ecstasy of the brick. I think that you wouldn't expect it in this building, which is so modest in its geometry and so simple, but actually the arch has this idea of a virtuoso arch. And if you look, for example, at the Baroque era, you will see that artists are always piling up arches, supporting them on their weakest points, and get a sort of acrobatics of architecture. Well, second point, the slide bar of scale. Or what might be called, in the work of MVRDV, for example, the variability of the pixel. And it pertains to the fact that today we can zoom out endlessly up to the Big Bang, and zoom in until we finally meet waves and electrons. And we might see both as clear and as sharp as possible. So it is, we have the possibility of a universal depth of field. So you can scale pixels, you know that from the computer. And there is an office in the Netherlands which does this. You can have a pixel on the scale of a brick, you can have a pixel on the scale of an apartment, and then you will go up until you have complete field of, let's say, high-rise buildings. And there is something interesting, because this implies that you might have the same gestures and the same movements in, for example, furniture, something very small, and an urbanistic plan. The same forms. Which implies, and I think this is a little bit difficult, implies that there is complete material indifference. That's, I think, the risk. We know this one, of course, which was the design of a villa, design of a house, which was scaled up, blown up, to become a music theater. Which not only says that there is indifference of function to form, but also of scale to form. And we already saw something like that in the Mannerist era, in the use of scrolls. And you can have a scroll on every level in architecture. And if you would study the designs of Michelangelo, was a very great architect, you would see that it is a sort of line, insinuating itself in the drawing, and then when it meets an architectural element, for example a pediment or a pedestal, it will pop up and scroll and get a certain measure. Can be a scroll, rolling up a thread, might be a console, might be a corbel, can be everything. Finally, they end up in these enormous huge scrolls at the Santa Maria della Salute in Venice. Well, it's not even clear if it's rolling up or unfurling. This one, especially beautiful. A keystone, which is just coming from this little scroll. This also means there is something like fluidity in typology. Well, these are those drawings. I'm the same. First he was drawing on a sort of rounded pediment, and then suddenly it breaks when he gets a commission to make an emblem in the pediment, and then things scroll up. This one, well, talking about protoplasm in architecture, about metamorphosis, can be everything, might become a staircase, whatever. Which is, I think, an interesting observation. We have many elements in the architecture of mannerism which might have that role. We might think of the step, part of the staircase. It has a riser and a tread. Optreden, aantreden. And if you scale that, you will get a whole family of elements. You will have the pedestal, you will have the stylobate. If looking at the wall, you will have indeed the recess, you will have the rhizolite, you will have in the ceiling the coffer, and you will have, of course, the staircase itself. This is a famous one, we all know this. This is the Biblioteca Lorenziana in Florence. This was always interpreted as the high pressure room of architecture. Now, what happens here is we see that the walls actually come forward between the columns, they advance between the columns. And contemporaries already interpreted this as a sort of pressure from the outside on the inside. And the recesses in these walls only confirm that. Now, it's a very small room, but indeed a huge staircase, which in a way exaggerates already in this enormous library. It breaks through the wall, and then it overwhelms and overflows the eye. And this feeling would have been even stronger, I think, if it would have been executed in Walden, which was the intention of Michelangelo. So having this stream of lava coming forward and breaking through the wall. Now, I think this interpretation is quite correct. There is much pressure in mannerist buildings, but there is more, I think, even more interesting. I think this wall is, in a way, full of images. They have to come out. And what you see is that, in certain details, pilasters are welling up. Elements are indeed coming forward in the corners. They almost jostle each other. So we have a sort of matter which wants to give you all the possible images you might think of. And this finally pertains to something like a metamorphosis in elements. And we see in the architecture of Michelangelo often that he doubles and triples and even quadruples the frame. Always they have their own level. And when falling back or coming forward, they change in character. Now we have the inner frame, for example, which has a rounded pediment. Then we have the second one with a triangular pediment. Then we get something like a quadrangular frame. And on all these frames, the orders change. First we have something like a stupid crawl, then a yoni order, and finally we get a composite order. And you might already feel that, for example, the cornice is this idea of a series of surfaces coming forward. The left one is, I think, even more beautiful. It's in the Sacrestia Nuova. And you see this first frame, which is quite simple, stepping forward in a pedestal. Then we have this double, let's say, Etruscan movement of the T, which in a way touches on, I think this must have been something like a virtual system, of course, a system of architecture. And when touching it, it suddenly leaps forward. Wow, it's such a beautiful frame, you actually don't need a sculpture in it. Well, there might be violence in these frames, but there is certainly also very much refinement in something like the micro steps of the styles. Well, for something completely different. Well, you see the same movements. A cornice on the right hand, you see a real mannerist cornice, and on the left hand, you see a mannerist cornice with the cornice of this escarpa in it. And you see the cornice, this is already an ironical gesture, it's filled up with matter, with nature, where it should, of course, be vertical and transparent. We see this cornice on very different scales. Micro cornice in these fixtures. We see the movement in the lectern. And of course, we see the frame itself, the cornice, where it should be, on top of what we call a field. And what it actually wants to say is that every surface, every facade, every elevation is just a surface among other surfaces. Actually, he says the whole world is full of those surfaces. And you can peel off every surface and you will see that there are all kinds of gestures which say that in a way. Then he makes these beautiful, wow, windows with this onyx cut so thin that you can look through it and that you actually assist to the creation of that form of matter. Corners going round, framing different elements, brass, well, the four elements, I think, the air, but also, indeed, metamorphizing into something like a cupola. Or, indeed, a stage, which is in the same family. Beautiful detail on the right. Well, indeed, the structures of all materials, concrete, so docile. But think of the formwork and the mold which must have made this. This mold must have been absolutely virtuoso. you must be a furniture maker to make such a mold. And you can see it, geometries are consequently eroded on the corner points, so there is a sort of erosion of the perfection of geometry. This one is, I think, especially beautiful. You might have an object has a contour, but this contour is just a moment in a series of moments, differing, coming forward, falling backward, and then changing the silhouette itself. And this one always reminds me of the theory of Lucretius, a Latin philosopher, in the times that there was no optical theory, and he said, well, we have these very, very, very thin pellicles. Every object has its pellicle. Those pellicles become loose and then travel through the air and touch the human eye, and that is what perception is. Well, if anything, we live in an era in which the staircase has been re-evaluated. Consider the fact that in the modern movement, staircases were always put outside the building. Like in the times of Alberti, they were something like a disturb of the plan. So you had to put them on another place, not in the geometrical perfection of the plan. And here it's, I think, in the heart of a building. It's the first rolled up street to be taken by horse. And it's a beautiful invitation to go up. Actually, you see the columns already going up, walking on the entablature, you only have to follow. Wow, we have here a similar case of a metamorphosis of those elements of the step. Truss, risers, becoming a stand or a tribune, becoming, of course, a staircase to enter the building, a stairway to heaven, and the other way around, of course, something like a cascade. This one is even more beautiful. I think it's something like a deformation of a flat surface. So actually it is a deep surface. It changes, and it is indeed a cascade of stairs. A vortex, if you begin at the upper side. A river going down. And if you look at the details indeed, you see that a rail in a window becomes a tread. This tread might become a floor, and the windows in it might be clerestories, might be fenêtres en longueur. There's a complete metamorphosis of typologies. So typology has become fluid. Now, last part. Going very quickly now, I accelerate. Texture, which is, I think, the lowest form of the dramatization of the surface. And an ideal might be, indeed, that concrete might come alive in something biological, vesicles, or even the skin. This is what is all happening in Amsterdam now. Might even be textiles. That's, I think, the original sense of tectonics. It's a sort of travesty of materials. We have structure, of course, today, which is not any longer the organization of space, which it was in the 60s and in the 70s. Repetition of elements in a structure. It has become something of the skin. We have relief, of course, which is an invitation for the sun to dwell upon the surfaces of architecture, but also for the hand to touch it. Rustication, typical mannerific elements, somewhere between absolute beauty, diamonds, mich hier rede ich saß. But also an aggressive texture. And this was also in the mannerist time itself. You might scale it up, you get another form of rustication, and finally you will end up with dramatizing the surface of the earth in a form of rustication. We see the work of Jan Ingels. Tectonics, to be interpreted in two ways. I will only show you the second one. This is very beautiful, of course. But to call this a dress is, I think, a little bit exaggerated. This one is far more beautiful because indeed tectonics pertains to this idea that in every material technique there are reminders or relics of other material techniques. So you have always metamorphosis in the elements, and usually we think of tectonics as this moment in which the construction on the one hand should be expressed or not be expressed in the facade itself. But this is the wrong question. The question is that something metamorphizes from one material technique to another one. And so we are far more free to capture forces and to make beautiful movements in the facade itself. Which was already done, of course, in the era of gesture par excellence, the Baroque. And this pertains, I think, to body. The body might be invited to take its place in the niches, in the recesses, and in the pleats of a facade. We have posture, which is, I think, a distortion of a surface. So actually, it's a surface escaping itself. We know it is metamorphosis. Indeed, roofs becoming facades. Facades becoming floors. We already saw that in the work of Hein Kohlhaas. But here it's also deformation, indeed, like we had in the figura serpentinata, which is actually the origin of all those movements we see today in architecture, in the work of Hadid, of UN Studio, the figura flamma. And what is actually beautiful is, I was 2 years ago in Venice at the Biennale, and she showed these bas reliefs. So she prefers not a spatial representation. Yes, there were models, of course, but this was her favorite way of showing how it worked. It's a deep surface. Well, again, beginning with a slab, and then you have the forces, and they make this surface a deep surface. Scale up another time. We will begin with dramatizing the surface of the earth. We get monsters. We already got them in the famous park of Bomarzo in Italy, and here in Ratolino, I think. A sort of hybrid between a sculpture, a building, and a landscape. I think we see exactly the same thing today in the architecture of MVRDV. This is, according to me, the new Bomarzo. It is architecturalizing landscape and landscaping architecture. You might look at the gardens of the Mannerist era, always terraced gardens, with a tension between the upper part and the lower part. You might get a sort of weaving in the work of Jan Ingels architecture, but they all have the same origin. And of course, these are terraced gardens too. And it is indeed a dramatization of the surface if you look at the way it was conceived. Well, this is exactly the texture for Google Earth, of course, for the orbit of Google Earth. So us being giants. This is the same. And yes, we should rationalize this. This is also sustainability, of course. We have to have arguments to do this. Well, this one I will skip, but
The end of it all is that I think the last surface to be conquered is, of course, the sky, which in itself is always dramatized in weather. And that's what we are going to grasp. We are going to make frames to catch the weather. This is actually a nice thing of rendering. Architects had to choose their backgrounds. And this made them aware of the fact that these backgrounds might be dramatic or stupid blue. And I think this helped them to see that the building is always a series of frames to frame this lost surface, or to indeed have a sort of imprint, the famous imprint of the cloud on the building. Well, then part two. Thank you.
Would you mind if we move directly to Schürz and then keep the last
minutes
for the Q&A?